to thank whichever one of you donut munching, barrel assed, pod pulling sissies leaked this to the press.
That's just what we need now.
Some sensational story in the papers making these boys out to be superheroes, triumphing over evil.
The following program may contain content not suitable for all audiences.
Fuck yeah, Will.
Just get that right out of the way.
Jason, what does that do for our rating?
There goes our PG rating.
Welcome to Exposition Street, celebrating geek movies in all their splendiferous glory. And we're coming at you today with episode number 5. We got a whole lot of stuff planned for you today. I think it's going to be a ton of fun. And I'm going to go ahead and introduce the panel real quick. So let me look here. Who have I got today? Let's see if he's loud. Rich?
I'm always loud.
Just checking. All right. Excellent. Vanessa?
Hello.
All right. That was a Vanessa check. We got Jason in the crowd.
Hello, hello.
And the kid.
Hello, party people.
Yeah, this is definitely a Red Banner review.
So, oh my gosh, I don't even know exactly where to start. Let's put this into perspective, okay? Now, this is a really important film. It's a film about two brothers on a divine mission to right society's wrongs and stand up for those who can't help themselves, all while leading local law enforcement on a merry chase through the streets of one of America's finest cities. Here's a clip.
For me and the Lord, we got to understand it.
We're on a mission from God.
Oh, yeah!
Wrong mission from God, Eric.
Oh, was that the wrong movie?
That's
the wrong movie, right?
Just
description, the wrong movie. One.
Fuck. Okay.
Which is why I was laughing so hard when you talked about reviewing Blues Brothers.
That's why it came up.
And then you said it was a mission from God, and I'm like, yeah. I gotta go. Have fun watching the movie. Let me know what you think.
Boondock Saints, guys. We're doing Boondock Saints.
Definitely.
I promise you. Now, ostensibly, it was released in November of 1999 originally, but again, it was a very limited release. It hit widespread release on January 1st, New Year's Day, the year 2000, to no acclaim. This movie cost them $6 million to make, and it made a grand total of $30,000 worldwide gross. U.S. gross. I don't think it actually went anywhere else. So that gives you an idea of what we're dealing with. This is the very definition of a cult following film.
It was in theaters for like 5 days.
Rated R, runtime 1 hour, 48 minutes. It again is pushing that 2 hour mark. We've been doing a lot of that on this show because that's where the good movies are. Official description from IMDb: two Irish Catholic brothers become vigilantes and wipe out Boston's criminal underworld in the name of God.
See, yeah. You could talk about the movie without using the F word.
Kind of.
That's why it was only one sentence, but
it took them a while to craft that. They had to work very hard to figure out the right configuration of words to leave out colorful metaphors.
My live tweet only had one use of friggin'.
I missed your live tweet.
I kind of need to check it. Your live tweet now.
Written and directed by Troy Duffy. Pretty much the only thing he ever did except Boondock Saints 2, All Saints Day, which I've never seen. I guess I probably need to put this out there just so everybody realizes in listener land. I know this is going to be weird, but I had never watched this movie before. And I'm pretty confident I'm the only one in the room who had never watched this movie before.
Which is the miracle.
Right. Even Vanessa had seen the movie before.
Right.
Even the kid had seen and he remembered having seen it. Because
I've seen it 5 times.
His wife loves the movie, so he'd seen it numerous times.
We actually... you mentioned the sequel. We actually went on to watch the sequel after we finished that movie. It's available streaming on Crackle for free.
I know
that says a lot.
It is nowhere near as good as the first one, but if you love the first one, you will enjoy the second one.
But I have heard they're trying to do some fun. They've been trying for years to do some funding for a third one.
Yeah,
it was set up for a third one at the end of the second.
It took them 9 years to do the second one, so it's only fair that it took them 10 to 11 to 12 to do the third.
Well, I mean, they have to grow their beards out again.
This movie was a trip. Music by Jeff Danna. Not Jeff's most well-known work. Not going to lie. He did a Resident Evil Apocalypse. The music for the Silent Hill movie, which, by the way, the soundtrack was much cooler than the movie.
The soundtrack was the best thing about the movie.
The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus was one of his. And most recently, Onward from Disney. I mean, dude's got a resume.
And what a diverse one.
starring Mr. Willem Dafoe.
Oh.
Holy crap. I did not expect this performance. I've always liked Willem Dafoe.
It was so good,
is
though.
He's incredible.
He's on my short list of people I know by name.
I understand why. This was around the same time as, I had to look because he's had like over 100, he's done over 100 movies. He's about the same time as Existence. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen that. It was kind of a off-kilter movie that came out about the same time, same year as The Matrix, and had similar type of feels, but nowhere near the budget. American Psycho was about the same time. Shadow of the Vampire was in 2000, same year. This was just a couple years after he did the turn as the villain in Speed 2, which was, you know, laughably lauded by some and razzied by others. I thought this bit of trivia was interesting, considering our recent conversations, quite possibly the most on-screen deaths of any mainstream actor. That is an IMDb fact.
Fascinating.
Which means I have no idea if it's true. Deaths include Platoon, spoilers, Last Temptation of Christ, by the way, Christ died.
What?
Speed 2, Cruise Control.
William Dafoe was Christ?
Well, I am. Existence.
Why didn't anyone ever tell me that?
I thought he was.
I thought you knew.
I thought that was common knowledge.
Shadow of the Vampire, Spider-Man, Once Upon a Time in Mexico. Let's go.
So he had more screen deaths than Sean Bean? Is that what you're saying?
That's what that seems to imply. I don't know if I buy it, but it could be that he just had more roles. I have no idea.
That was my assumption.
No idea.
Maybe
it's about the only way
we'll
you pull that off.
We'll have to look at the percentage.
Yeah, there has to be a dig into that.
Someone might even look. I don't even know if one who's older. I mean, they're both, you know, they both had kind of an aged look from them all their lives. You know?
Right. One's got a lot bigger range, though.
In so many ways.
They have about the same number of acting credits. Got 134 to 113.
Not bad. That's close enough. I'd say Willem is definitely one of the most gifted thespians of his generation, I think. He's definitely pulling out all the stops in every role he's in.
Right.
I've seen him in some pretty shitty movies, the kind that are really hard to remember the names of. And he's the only thing you remember about the damn movie. I mean, they're not always great characters. You certainly don't like a lot of them, but that's like, what he does.
When I see his face, I know I'm in for a good ride.
It pains me to mention this, but like Netflix adaptation of Death Note, for example.
Oh, was he in that?
He's
the only good character in that.
Which is what I just said, isn't it?
Not he's surprising. The
death god. Yeah. And William Dafoe makes an incredible death god.
He does.
Quite happy with
interesting.
It.
Interesting.
Okay. Actually, I haven't watched that, but I've seen the animated Death Note, and I can see Willem Dafoe in that screenshot.
That role, that persona.
He is so good.
Just
and
give
the
him an apple, and he's good.
Oh,
you guys.
No makeup required. Just an apple.
Do yourself a favor, though. Don't watch the live action adaptation. Just
let it go.
Just stop there.
Just
forget
about it.
So that one's not on the list, right?
Okay. Oh, I'm sure it is on the list, but
yeah,
it'll lead to an interest.
It's on some list.
It's on the Vino list.
Sean Patrick Flannery. Not interestingly enough, not a places I a lot of places I knew him from. His IMDb portfolio showed a lot of roles, but most of them were television. He was in Suicide Kings a couple years before this, which is another movie I've always wanted to see, never got around to seeing.
Oh, so good.
He plays,
but it needs to be far, far removed from this one on the list.
Since Jason loved it, I've no idea what I'm going to expect from the movie. Norman Reedus. Same year he did 8mm, a couple years before Blade 2. He was kind of in an interesting place in his career. And good-looking kids. I mean, they make an interesting pair. They were very compelling, I felt, in the role of brothers.
My wife agrees with everything you just said,
yes.
There, by the way.
Oh, okay. I was just going to ask her. No, I really feel like... Love you, Julie.
Her comment when they were stripped in the shower scene was, I'll take two sets, please.
Oh, there you go. No, they might be for hire. I mean, their acting career doesn't seem to be going as far nowadays. I don't know.
Norman Reedus is still in Walking Dead.
There is The Walking Dead. Okay, that's true. That's true. And to be fair, I mean, I know he's Daryl. I don't watch the show. I've never watched more than a couple episodes of the show, so
but
I tend to forget it.
You know he's Daryl.
But I know. I still know, and that says something. So, yeah. And that's still, I guess, current enough, right? Basically.
I'm pretty sure his character's still alive. I have no idea.
I will admit that the two of them were so fluid in the roles and the kind of the sameness they were bringing to the roles that I would get them mixed up in the movie. Now, I've only watched it the once, and I mean, that's, I realize, a weird thing to say, because you're not necessarily supposed to have to watch a movie more than once to kind of get it, But I've only watched it the once, and I watched it in like two parts while I was pulling clips. So I watched half of it on Thursday and the other half this morning. It was a rough week.
Oh, no.
I was pleasantly impressed with their performances, though. I felt their characters were compelling, and I found them charismatic. I liked it. It's interesting the way they take, and I don't know if you guys feel the same way, because again, the way I always want to get your feelings on this, because I watched the movie in a different way. You guys are sitting down, presumably sometime during the week, watching the movie critically, making a few notes, whatever, but probably generally watching it all in one piece and still maintaining connection with the flow of the movie.
Yes.
I'm not getting that experience. So this kind of is the kind of exactly the question I need to pass off. But it felt like in the beginning of the movie, in the first like half hour of the movie, they were taking some pains to give you a feel for the characters, bringing out their personality, giving you a hint of that charisma that made them so interesting and made them who they are. But then they get real kind of, I mean, other than a couple of scenes where they're dealing with situations comedically, they get real serious the rest of the film.
And that's where it happened. Hard. They built the characters up in the first part. They really did. And then they shifted out focus on the bigger story, because at that point there were a lot of balls in play.
Yeah. And bullets, actually. I noticed a lot of those,
and
too.
At that point, they started having to develop some other characters that we hadn't seen so much of.
This is true.
Right. I guess we should talk about some of that. So I don't have the characters' names in front of me. Sean Patrick Flannery, Norman Reedus.
Connor and Murphy McManus.
Yeah. I loved their tattoos on their hands.
Yes.
Equitas and Veritas.
Yes.
Their tattoos were awesome all over the place.
On their necks and on their arms. And
what a cool presentation they made. Now,
I'm
going to be straight with you. Now, I know the movie came out in 99, and I meant to stop and look at how it came out in contrast to, because it's been a few years, other movies around that time that were pinnacle points in the way cinema was being presented at the time. A lot of indie films were being made. Like I said, this film was only $6 million on the budget. Nowadays, that is even possible. But at the time, that was still significant enough to mean that they could expect to have a good-looking movie.
And most of that money was spent on squibs.
And this was in an analog era, of course. So there was a really, I think, well-defined movie. I wouldn't have been able to tell you that it was low budget. For example, there's nothing about it that screamed low budget to me, which I thought was pretty impressive when you think about it.
The fades actually were the only thing that left that feel in my mouth.
But that seemed intentional. Mm-hmm. That felt very much like
they were so consistent with it, it ended up feeling like part of the character. But
and that's a really good way of putting it. It was actually kind of the character in the movie. The narrative in this movie was so peculiar, and that's what I liked about the movie the most. Especially the way they would do the scenes where you would see the start of something that's about to happen, and then we go straight to the cops investigating it and go into the flashbacks with Willem Dafoe's character. Anybody got his name on hand? He was an interesting
Paul Smecker. Smecker or
someone? Paul Smecker.
Yeah. Boy, he was an interestingly conflicted character.
He was awesome.
And I loved his arc. I mean, again, Willem Dafoe. There you go.
Oh, man.
I got to tell you, there were so many things in this movie that I watch it and I'm like, everything about this movie should offend me for one reason or another. But I set it all aside like some sort of weird suspension of political correctness disbelief.
Yeah.
Enjoy the movie and say, like, oh, I want to watch that movie again. Even though there's so many things that, quote unquote, trigger me if I think about it for even a second.
I had to make a very valid decision going into this, because I tried. We tried. We're running a clean, family-friendly show, guys. We tried. We discussed before.
We made it four episodes.
Yeah. We discussed before that maybe if we have an R-rated flick, and we did with Constantine, for example, but it wasn't littered with bad language. If we have an R-rated flick, we might end up with a kind of R-rated show. It might be unavoidable. And we'll still do our best to be friendly about it. But when it came to pulling clips for this show,
yeah,
I would, if I tried to avoid every F-bomb in the show, I would have ended up with four clips and one of them would have been funny. I mean, it just wasn't a great show.
And one of them would have been nothing but gunfire.
Yeah, that's true.
All this.
Because you know I like to do that. But I really felt that kind of said something too. It's a character in the show, not in terms of like making the language important, but the language is part of who they are and the environment, the world that they live in, and how you as a viewer are supposed to relate to it.
It's so immersive.
It was important, I think, to embrace that, not avoid it. So if you're sensitive to that, I'd suggest you kind of bug out before we get to clips. But
it's bad.
We will try to have an intelligent conversation about it.
But it's a cult
trying to remember the number. I think it was 2.38 Fs per minute. in the movie, on
something
average.
Like that, yeah.
It was ridiculous. But that being said, I felt like it was very watchable. And there were, like Rich was just kind of implying there, there were things that I could have captured in the movie that I decided not to because they were just over the line fashion.
There's really only one part that would have super uncomfortable clips, and
there
that's
was one
the joke.
Part that was way bad.
Well, there's another thing though, and we could talk about that. I mean, there's no reason to avoid it. We just don't have to use the language, and that's that the when they're dealing with the is it Russian mobster? No, it's just Italian mobster.
It was Italian mobster.
He insists when they're talking about the various racial epithets, he insists on using the N-word and correcting the guy every time he tries to say something socially acceptable, you know?
And our anti-hero isn't even comfortable doing that.
Yeah, you mean N-word. That's what I said, you know, like that.
Then say it.
But like Willem Dafoe, his character was really self-oppressed. Self-repressed.
Yeah.
And,
his
art would really offend me a lot out of anybody in a normal thing. And for some reason, this movie, I was just like I can deal with
it. But
he
was very hard on the other gays in the film because his character obviously was.
Very repressed.
And he was very hard and used.
Repressed is the right word
language.
Because he was expressive and not hidden at all. I would say self-loathing, perhaps.
Self-loathing is expressive.
Self-loathing,
no
definitely.
Way repressed.
But,
but by the end of the movie, though. Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a good turn.
Oh, my God, yes.
That all still.
So I didn't expect it. And that was the nice thing about it.
It's somewhat offensive in a way.
I got to give you guys credit.
I still loved the movie.
You guys all talked about how much you liked the movie, and you didn't give anything away. I got to the end of this film with absolutely zero apprehension of what was going to happen. And this is what I haven't said yet. I was a little ambivalent about this movie. Not entirely going into it, because it was a cult classic. I knew people loved it. I love movies. So there wasn't any reason to expect that I wouldn't. And I enjoy action movies. I enjoy violent movies. I enjoy mafia movies. I enjoy all the things that are related to this. So not a big deal. And that graphic over the top stuff doesn't bother me at all. The language doesn't bother me. I'm pretty clear about everything. A movie is an experience you immerse yourself into and you just roll with it. But we started getting into the first half of this movie, and I'm sitting here, and I watched the first half on Thursday and had to take a break because of other stuff and gaming, of all things. God, stupid schedule. And I got to that point, and I'm sitting here going, I'm not sure I don't hate it or anything, but I'm not sure I really like it. And that was the point I was at. There were things about it I really liked. I really liked things with the characters. I really wasn't sure what the story was trying to say. The end of this movie blew my freaking mind. And the scene that did it may or may not be the scene that does it to everybody, but it was good. And it kept on coming. Once it started, bam, 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 and then a quiet little bam. I mean, it was really fantastic. And we'll get to some of that, obviously.
Billy Connolly, my goodness.
I hadn't even mentioned him yet. And he took my breath away. The minute I saw him on the screen, I knew we were going to get
You're
something
like,
good.
Oh, it all makes sense now.
I didn't even get the implication until, but I didn't see it coming, rather. I got the implication. I didn't see it coming. I didn't see exactly that coming. And then he starts, when he hears them saying the prayer, and he starts saying it with them, and they mentioned it early in the movie. It was a family prayer.
Yeah.
Everything clicks.
Wow. Boom.
That just slammed into me so hard. I was just like, this just elevated from a fantastic movie to oh my fucking God.
So much so, by the way, that is, and this is something I do not do, especially when I'm pulling clips, so much so that I went back to earlier in the movie and made sure I'd heard that right. Because they didn't do anything else to confirm it right then.
No.
Except
no.
for the actions of the characters. And then there was one little sentence at the very end of the movie. When he calls him Da.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I'm, am I right? Am I right? Am I right? Turn on the subtitles. Yes, I'm right.
See, I just had to watch the movie a second time. I didn't, you know, mess around with any of that.
So, oh, Da, watching the movie a second time.
But I knew you'd like the movie because you like Blues Brothers and you like Snatch.
Oh, dude, I enjoyed the hell out of this. And this was
so
a
I knew
fun
you were
movie.
There.
I'm glad I got a chance to watch it. At some point, I'm going to have to watch it again in one shot without all the interruptions.
That would be nice.
And really enjoy it. But I do absorb movies really well in any form. The only thing, like I said, that I'm afraid I lose, and it really is uncertainty, is some stuff about the pacing and the way, you know, the flow of a film and making sure I'm not forgetting details that matter.
But that was the interesting thing. It had comic book pacing.
It did.
And I thought...
Did you say this was a graphic novel?
I knew there was a graphic novel, but I went back and looked it up. The graphic novel came out 7 years, 6 or 7 years after the movie, not before. Okay,
so it was like an adaptation or extension.
It has comic book pacing, which is what they did. It translated well to a graphic novel.
It would be nice to see, I mean, something else this Troy Duffy guy has done to get an idea where he was coming from with this. Obviously, it was a personal story for him because he wrote and directed it and nothing else.
I love those transitions where they're like pivot on a thought and the whole scene switches to the other side of that thought from a different person's perspective.
That was amazing. What I didn't really dig was what the kid was referring to earlier, and that's the fades. Mm-hmm. I got what it's doing as being a characteristic of the narrative, but I didn't like the style.
And that was why I mentioned it, because it was one of the few things in the movie that just kind of left me with a slight jar.
It felt disruptive. Not artistically disruptive, it felt unnecessarily disruptive. And that is that's a hard line to kind of cross. It's not real clear.
But also, to me, that was poetry. That was movie poetry.
Where it was editing. It was intentional.
Allowing us to pause and then move to the next verse.
But for me, it's very significant because I don't notice cinematography or the things that are connected to it, like scene transitions, fades. I don't notice that stuff unless it gets my attention in either a good or bad way. And usually, unfortunately, it's in a bad way, because good ones, I'm so immersed in the experience that it's just part of the experience.
I guess I get that, because Star Wars wipes always drove me crazy, the way they wipe the screen. It's always a wipe with a weird transition line.
And a couple of those dissolves were clunky enough that I noticed them, so I know what you're talking about.
I pay attention to DP work, because I love that part of the art.
See, I'm there to forget I'm watching a movie. I'm there to be immersed in the world on the screen and exist, you know, outside of this one for a while. So things that pull me out of that experience, I notice. Things that don't are invisible to me, and that's the way I like it.
I don't mind the fourth wall disappearing.
It's hilarious that one of my biggest positives last week was the transitions, and my biggest negative this week is the transitions.
They were completely different.
There are no transitions. It's stop, black, start. Stop, black,
but it's not
start.
Black. I actually liked the transitions in this movie.
Oh. I enjoyed it greatly. I thought it was very artistically well done.
Exactly.
Well, you see it done in similar way in films like even Pulp Fiction, where he interspersed that by creating chapter headings and stuff. It had a similar feel to it than helped. That. But when Tarantino did that, he made it feel like this was a recognizable break that was meaningful, and we were identifying it that way, and it felt natural. Even though it disrupted the narrative, it felt natural. You know, probably because we are used to thinking of those of narratives in those terms.
It took me 3 times watching Pulp Fiction to really get what was going on. I'm just saying.
I've only seen it once, and I have no idea what happened.
Is that why I don't like it? Because I only watched it once?
Oh, yeah. Pulp Fiction, though, I guarantee you that's it.
It's an asynchronous narrative, though. So it's done that way in order to create 3 separate stories that tie together in a weird way. But I freaking loved Pulp Fiction. I don't know if that'd be a good one to do for the show at any point. We could, but it's kind of a sacred cow for a lot of people. So I don't know if it'd be one that listeners would enjoy as much. But I know we'd have stuff to talk about, because Jason would definitely have things to criticize.
I have no problems milking a sacred cow.
So here's an interesting thing I thought. The very beginning with the church sequence was a very interesting way to set a tone, that they kept returning to in cool ways through the movie. They did a lot of it with music. There's a lot of sequences where they would have like something that seemed like incongruous with the music, which was suddenly Gregorian style, you know, something in the background over here. Monks, you know, doing their thing. But yeah, there was that. But also, obviously, the imagery, not in terms of like just like what they're wearing. I mean, they would sometimes with the crosses and stuff, they'd get back to that, but the rosary, but they're also like the, like poses, you know, the way they would stand, the way the camera would shoot the two of them together from a certain angle would look similar to when they were at the altar in the opening sequence, things like that.
Exactly.
There's a lot of, I thought, cool kind of reminiscent imagery built throughout, like a little callbacks in the photography.
Oh yeah.
Throughout the film. And that's neat. You don't see a lot of that, I think. And it's because it is an arc that is intended to refer to itself throughout so that the ending is as poignant as the beginning makes it out to be. Because a lot of the stuff in the middle makes you kind of question.
Right. I mean,
oh, hey, the killers. That's fun.
Yeah.
But that was good. I really liked that. The sermon at the beginning, I think I even captured some of that. But the whole thing at the beginning kind of set a tone that I wasn't sure where they were going with. But then it devolves to the bar scene and then the alley scene and then the police station and just like.
And if you know anything about the movie, you go through that first part of the movie as they're going up there and you keep expecting him to kill somebody. Right? But it was just really building up that piousness and that they were really good boys with a really strong directive in their life.
And there was a who'd you say was in the movie? We hadn't talked about. What's his name? You mentioned him last week.
Ron Jeremy.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even realize it. I was watching this and I'm like, oh, I mentioned that somebody looked like a miniature Ron Jeremy last week. And
Danny
Ron
DeVito. Jeremy's
actually in the film this week.
Which gave me a great chance to compare. And you were right. Danny nailed that mini
With that
Ron
mustache,
Jeremy look.
He looks a lot like a mini Ron Jeremy.
And in fact, Danny DeVito could have played this character and it would have been just as convincing. It was
that was
except
hilarious.
I'm not as convinced.
It wouldn't have been
quite as slimy.
That you don't think he can do slimy quite as well?
I don't think anyone on Earth can do slimy like Ron Jeremy.
It's built in.
Ron Jeremy is the human definition of slimy. It's just Ron Jeremy.
He did like 4 porn films before he became slimy, and it stuck ever since.
Oh, he has pre-slimy porn out there, huh? Wow.
This is not the place to discuss that.
Well, particularly since it was
a different podcast I do.
I think there's a lot to be said for using that in their favor in this, but it was an odd choice. And of course, the role didn't require much. But
it was fun to watch him get his just desserts at the end.
Yes, that's exactly the comment I was about to make. That made it so worthwhile.
So I was trying to think if anything else was a standout to me, anything else that really kind of,
so many bit characters done well. They were all done well. You could tell who was Italian. You could tell who was Russian. You could tell who was Irish.
I also liked the core. So, and they visited a little bit early on and then they visited a hardcore at the end, of course, because it was the point. But that vigilante construct, the idea that they were like the little clip I played in the opening. They were being seen as heroes.
Yeah.
When at the time they hadn't hardly done anything.
For the
and it was people in the police department propagating that.
So I thought that was kind of fun. Particularly at the end.
Yeah.
Right. But that also goes, a lot of the people in the police department were Irish. And they were Irish, as opposed to the Russians and the Italians.
I know, Kid, you said you watched it last night, but I cannot, off the top of my head, decide where I would have gone writing a sequel to this. I mean, the obvious direction in terms of their role, but where the story would go, I mean,
anything that you would imagine, it's not.
They actually did with it was a hard right in a lot of ways. And in fact, that was the biggest thing that upset me about it, because it leaves this... I don't want to spend a bunch of time talking about the sequel, but they do not do what the end of this movie basically blatantly screams they're going to do. And it makes no sense, and it's never justified or explained in the story. But they managed to do such a good job of doing something else that it's easy to forgive that.
Okay.
But it pulls enough away that this cannot be compared to the original movie. Boondock Saints is a masterpiece. Its sequel is an enjoyable film.
That makes me think of the Bill and Ted thing, where you have characters that are established the way they are in the first movie. You have a story that's charming and built around it. They make a sequel to it and they're trying to capitalize on the things that made the characters what they were. But the idea at the end of the first movie was they were going on to great things. So you have a second movie where they haven't gotten around to going on to great things.
Mm-hmm.
So then at the end of the movie, they make you look like they're going on to great things. And now they have a third movie coming out that looks like they never got around to doing the great things. 100 years later.
Right.
And now we have John Wick and Sick Bill.
Right.
I think...
In Bill and Ted, I would not have liked the second movie if that was the only movie put out. But I liked it because I liked the first movie.
Have you guys seen the trailer to Bill and Ted Face the Music?
I haven't seen any of the Bill and Ted movies.
I don't know how I feel. Oh, that we have to correct. That we have to correct. We have got to at least sit you down with some Bill and Ted.
Dude,
that first movie was bogus. So worth it.
But that one's worth reviewing.
That one's worthy for the list.
I'm adding it to the list.
I don't know
list.
If it's on any.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. The second one, maybe excellent. Not. But
if you have suggestions for our list, feedback at
prismaticsunami.com. Well done, guys.
And if you're thirsty while you're making that recommendation,
assaulttees.shop. We're not sponsored.
Go to hell.
This is not that podcast. That's the other podcast.
But if you don't buy tea other from assaulttees, at least make sure you drink water. Stay hydrated.
Yeah,
it is important to stay hydrated.
We have a Discord. It's picking up some steam, some activity. There's a little bit of stuff going on there.
Woot woot.
James from 1D4Cast found us, and we hooked him up with some of his channels. And the next thing I know, I've been getting some messages from him anyway. And he told me he was shipping me something. This has nothing to do with anything, of course. But it showed up today, FedEx. And he sent me 2 12-packs of this.
The Diet Dr. Pepper Cream Soda.
That I'm having an impossible time finding in Wichita. Thank you, James. You made my day.
Stand-up guy right there.
It's really kind of awesome.
He's been great on the Discord, too.
He's a cool guy. Yeah.
Meanwhile, back to all the murdery murder.
Murdery murder.
Vigilanteism.
It should have been
murder. Like it's a bad thing. Come on, man.
Murder. In the streets of Boston.
Murdery murder.
It is an odd mix of one shot and can't hit.
I got to tell you guys, I like Boston. I don't know why. I like Boston as a backdrop.
My favorite movie of all time is in Boston, set in Boston.
That's really vague. I appreciate it.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Appreciate
and
that.
What would if we ever
Boston
end up doing
set
it on...
movie be?
Oh, see, I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah.
But if we end up doing it, you'll get to hear all about it.
Okay.
You should totally add it to the list. That way we have to guess which one it is.
The town always has just a kind of a touch of a gothic feel to it, and then with the very heavy Irish population and influence on the city and the culture, I've just always enjoyed it. Leverage, the TV show Leverage, was set in Boston, and I enjoyed the hell out of
it. That show.
I just really feel like it adds something, and you know, especially since so many movies can be anywhere. You know, they said in New York or Chicago or L.A.,
Philadelphia,
not so much in Wichita
City here.
That's
Big Kahuna was set here. It was great.
It was great. But I felt like the city was definitely kind of a character in the movie. I mean, it wasn't a heavy part of it, but it had a feel that was important, especially because of the Irish cops and stuff. It was kind of a big part of the way
Irish
it came
cops and the Irish neighborhood silence.
Yeah, yeah.
There were at least Irish 5 distinct solidarity references to it's a 100% Irish neighborhood. No one talked to the cops.
I'm assuming they shot in Boston. They didn't have to, but
wouldn't surprise me.
I'm assuming so.
Based on the credits, it did say, you know, filmed in Boston. Da 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 da.
Anybody got anything else they want to talk about the movie specific? I could go ahead and pull some clips up and kind of get into that a little bit. You guys want to?
Let's go with clips, and if we have anything else to say, we can say it.
Very clever, sir. Very clever. I got. I just call this one opening.
When I wear my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on judgment, I will take vengeance upon mine enemies, and I will repay those who hate me. O Lord, raise me to thy right hand and count me among thy saints.
I love the music. It just goes on and on. That was a really kind of nice feel, nice tone.
How have I watched this movie all these times and just realized that Billy Connolly had the opening monologue?
Opening narrative? Yeah, I didn't realize it until I was checking out the clips later.
It was the third time
I saw it that I caught that.
Awesome.
And it was the fourth time that I realized that he never speaks in character until after you know who he is. Which, if someone was paying hyper close attention to that opening and recognized his voice, would have spoiled it.
Yeah, he does not talk until it's more or less revealed what
his
character is.
Which has the advantage of building the character.
Oh yeah, it's beautifully done.
His character is so incredibly built by the time it's revealed who he actually is. I thought that character was super well done.
Il Duce.
Yeah. I always think that there's an interesting kind of mechanism. We first saw it in Silence of the Lambs, where we develop an idea of a criminal who is so dangerous just by virtue of the way that everybody else treats him. Mm-hmm. You know, the criminal in question never has to do anything that dangerous on screen, but you know you do not want to mess with him. You know, Hannibal Lecter was super scary, and all he had to do was stick his tongue out when he talked a little bit. I mean,
and never blink. He did not blink through that entire movie.
Anthony Hopkins. I'm not sure Anthony Hopkins blinks, so that's okay. But
it might not have been a character choice.
Wow. You know, and I think it's particularly funny. What was it? It was Con Air, the Nick Cage film, which I love, by the way. And it was Con Air where Steve Buscemi plays Garland Green.
Has that Weasley dude. He's the crazy psycho killer guy.
And he acts like Weasley completely dude. Normal the whole movie. But you feel like he's so threatening because when they roll him out on the cart with all the muzzle and the chains and stuff, and the cops carry him a length along poles and stuff to... Wow.
Huh. I apparently need to see Con Air.
Oh, Con Air. Yeah, that's another one. Well, we need to stop doing that to you, Vanessa. I'm sorry.
I know.
Oh, look at Jay. Just shaking his head. No. That seriously? Wow. I guess it's worth asking real quick if there's a Nick Cage problem in the group.
Oh, absolutely not. I love Nick Cage. I also love hating Nick Cage.
He's in so many things. So, I mean, really, it's a love-hate no matter who you ask because he's in so many things. It's a Nick Cage
teeter-totter.
The winky graphic you send me is from Con Air. The one where I said, my eyes aren't good enough and I'll wear my glasses to see the little winky face. So you put that big winking winking Nick Cage graphic with the wind blowing through his hair?
Yep.
Con Air?
Good stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. So, yes.
The GIF was great. The movie was not.
Star Trek humor?
I am Yvonne Chekhov, and you will be closing now.
I'm typing on the screen.
Chekhov. Well, this here's McCoy. We find a Spock, we got us an away team.
That was one of my tweets.
That was so out of nowhere, and it felt like it was so out of nowhere the rest of the movie. So it's like...
That was a thing I didn't mention in characters. Doc, at the beginning of the film, the bartender Doc, and his language.
With Tourette's.
He's the guy from Fraggle Rock.
That's where
you should see him in the sequel.
He's the guy from Fraggle Rock.
Was his name in Fraggle Rock Doc too?
I think so, yes.
I totally did not see that.
And I was like, oh, it's so great to see him swearing.
Yeah, it was Doc.
What the hell was the name of the dog in Fraggle Rock? It was what he said. The one word Sprocket. He said the most in Sprocket. Oh, Sprocket. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Blows your mind totally now. Him. When you go to rewatch it, it's going to be so fun watching him swear and stutter.
Oh, the Tourette's was good.
That was so well portrayed.
I was very
happy with
properly
that.
Understated. I mean, it wasn't made fun of. It was just part of the character, and it was done very well.
And 99% of the time, if you see Tourette's make an appearance in a movie, a TV show, something, it is misrepresented
made fun
in
of.
Ways that are damaging to the people who actually suffer from this particular
disability. I had a close friend growing up who had Tourette's.
And I know,
they did
I remember.
Slightly yeah. make fun of it.
Well, the people made fun of him, which you kind of have in to expect way. If you're a sufferer, but he himself didn't mock the disability.
No,
he played it really
portrayed
well.
It
he played
beautifully.
It really well.
And the fact that they were able to do that in this movie, just as a complete aside, I was...
Yeah,
I
as soon as I figured really that out, I was like, that. We have a couple of Fraggle Rock mega fans over here in the
I
group.
I knew he looked incredibly familiar.
I was surprised you didn't pick up on that. I was expecting to see that in your live tweet.
I felt like there was a Doc in Fraggle Rock. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I felt like there was something to the character. I don't know. Maybe they wanted to do more with him or anything, but they went through some trouble to develop him pretty strongly.
He is one of the characters who makes an appearance in the sequel. A significant
he's a bigger
appearance
part
at that.
In the sequel, yeah.
Oh, cool.
Good. I look forward to watching
was
that.
Was one
then.
Of the things I really enjoyed.
In this movie, his bar was the whole thing about the clash of the different mafias fighting over territory and trying to
the
take,
Russian and Italian,
shake down or take control of businesses.
Bagel with my coffee.
Oh, no way. You know how big a guy's going to do that? Fucking huge.
Oh, really? I might just be wanting a bagel with my coffee.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
I ain't getting him no fucking bagel.
what was the character's name? McGreeley or something like that?
Greenlee.
And that was one of those. That was that scene where like he was finding like they were digging out the shell casings and stuff. It was proven. I mean, that was the whole introduction to Willem Dafoe's character. Really,
every time he proved him wrong, he asked for food.
That was my favorite running gag in the entire movie.
I knew
exactly.
I knew it would be.
Asking for the coffee, asking for the bagel, asking for anything. Everything was, you're wrong, so now you're the subordinate.
I thought that would really speak to you. When I met the kid, he was running an ammo reloading service for the Irish mob. Pennies on the dollar made a killing. I felt like it was really kind of home territory for you. And you'd relate to it very strongly.
Oh, I do. I do.
And you remember what happens. I mean, this is exactly,
man, the nostalgia.
Yeah, it's exactly the kind of thing you have to avoid when the feds come in.
I wasn't there for that.
Well, yeah, right. That's why you're still here today.
Right.
Kiss your mama.
I'd like to thank whichever one of you donut munching barrel assed pod pulling sissies leaked this to the press.
Tough.
That's language. Just what we need now. Some sensational story in the papers making these boys out to be superheroes, triumphing over evil.
Evil.
When it came to clips, I can't get enough of Smecker.
Oh my gosh, my favorite character in the entire movie.
There is a reason why the movie poster is two-thirds his head and then a little tiny each of the brothers.
More Smecker, I think.
Is there any way that we could stay here?
Yeah, you know, we have an extra holding cell. You guys can... Can they stay?
Well, we'll have to check with your mom. But it's okay with me if your friends sleep over.
And just the attitude while he's giving the line, because he's got, like, the hand on the hip and everything.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, is it just me? Is he... I mean, right from the very beginning, he has a little bit of effeminate quality in what he's doing. I mean, he's advertising the character.
He does the same thing Johnny
strongly.
Depp does in the pirate movie.
Yeah, but...
A little swish. Well, Johnny Depp exaggerated that further into the movies, but it was a character choice.
But it wasn't intimated in the movie. This was something that was intimated and then paid off.
Confirmed. Because, yeah.
You know, when you see him a few scenes later and he's got a dude in bed with him, you're like, oh, okay, so that isn't just an effeminate character. He's actually... You know, living the life, or living the lie is the case.
But then he starts the self-loathing part of it.
Oh my gosh! But yeah, I thought he was snarky as hell. Really,
oh yeah, he was a great character. He was my favorite the entire movie.
I think it's about the point it starts getting kind of heavy. Destroy all evil. What do I mean by this? Let's see.
Nobody. Whosoever shed man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man.
Winner.
You know, that's what you see.
So that was just good to be flourish.
Music. Is that what you were doing over there, Jason? Was that? Is that that was the bit where wasn't over there? Like
they're
raising
baptized.
Out of bed.
They were baptized into the cause.
They were baptized into God's mission by the leak in the jail roof.
Oh my gosh, that was vivid. It was such
a well done scene.
Hardcore. Okay, I know everybody's gonna love this, so brace yourselves. Here it is.
Fucking what the fucking fuck? Who the fuck? Fuck this fucking! How did you two fucking fucks? Fuck!
Well, it certainly illustrates the diversity of the work.
And I so thought. When I got to this point when I was pulling clips, I so thought, I'm going to use Mario coins for this stuff, right? Ding, I mean, we're going ding, to like ding out some. And I got to that clip and I'm like, I can't not do this clip. I can't do 2,800 Mario coins in a row.
You could have done it if you had played the Mario Invincibility Star theme behind it. That would have been beautiful. But no, I'm glad you kept it on it.
Oh my gosh.
But that clip so incorporates how the entire movie is.
That last line again.
Certainly illustrates the diversity of the work.
Best writing in the damn movie.
Yes.
Oh. It slayed me. That was so good.
Good line.
Call this one 7-Eleven.
We're sort of like 7-Eleven. We're not always doing business, but we're always open.
That was nicely put.
Thank you very much.
I think this was an interesting point. I wanted to capture that because I felt like it kind of settled a question in my head at that point about where the characters were in this arc. You know, because up to that point, you really are following kind of the action and behavior of the characters in a very sort of interpersonal way, but you're kind of in the vehicle. You're kind of watching them going through what they're going and not necessarily understanding or apprehending how much investment they have in it beyond just this is what they believe they have to do. This says we're kind of enjoying this. This says we're finding ourselves and it's got its moments. It's cool. It's cute. It's whatever. It's snark. Is a little bit of snark for the fun of it, in deference to the fact that they were killing evil people. It was really kind of cool.
One of my favorite lines happened just a little right around here somewhere, too, was, it's bad television. That's what this is.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Smecker. At some point, I had to draw the line on nothing but Smecker. I was just going to have the Smecker show up.
There's no such thing as too much Smecker.
Smecker's such a good character.
The listeners can go watch
that,
the movie.
That it's okay. Scene, though, that scene you're referencing, because that look, he does that expression so well, that moment of epiphany, it's television.
It's bad television.
That's what this is.
A professional would never do this.
Wasn't that in the Russian scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was in the hotel.
Yeah.
Where I don't want to spoil the movie, but it was the
this
hotel
entire
scene.
Podcast is spoiling the movie.
Well,
it's
we're all spoiling.
We're trying to avoid giving too much detail for people who might still be able to enjoy seeing these scenes without knowing. You know,
fair enough.
You should definitely watch the movie.
Okay, so me, it's just me. I'm the only one doing
podcast.
That.
This is more of a review, yep. Not a recommendation.
If you haven't watched the movie yet, pause this live broadcast right here. Go watch the movie, and then come back and resume it where you left off.
Well, the majority of people will be listening to the podcast, and they should have.
If they haven't paused it by now, it's too late.
It's never too late.
We've already talked about Connelly. Not too late.
You can pause it and go back.
This is the first show we have done on Exposition Street that is uniformly everyone liked it. No,
we haven't gotten to ratings yet.
We haven't done our ratings yet. You don't know me.
We have not done ratings yet.
No, but every single one of us, I was going to say every single one of you, but I'm more guilty than most, it has just been absolutely loving talking about the movie, and it shows how much you enjoyed the movie.
That's a fair point.
But we knew that was going to happen with some shows, too, no matter what. I mean,
and this is, I just wanted to point out, this is the first one. You know, if you're coming back 15 years from now and going through our archives, and you've just now gotten to our fifth episode, this was the first one.
I think we were all kind of together on Big Fish on some stuff. Mostly.
For the most part.
For the most part, yeah.
It just wasn't all...
We had different takeaways.
It wasn't all just nothing but love. And This has a lot of love in it. I mean, we're pretty
there's
much
a lot
in a good
of love
place,
for
I
this.
Think.
But, of course, we also haven't got to the hate yet. Because There's a lot of hate, too.
There are some things wrong with this movie.
This line I actually didn't catch, and then... was it Vanessa who first asked if I'd caught it?
No, it was me.
It was Jason.
I asked like five times. Over the course of the
Jason
last week.
Kept asking if I caught this line.
I asked
and
like
I was
five
like,
times.
I have at the time I'd only done half the movie, and I'm like, well, I'm sure I will. I just obviously just probably haven't got there yet or whatever.
Like I was hoping you would catch this one, but he was the one definitely asking about it.
It turns out that I had already been through this scene. It's just that what happens took me so off guard that I kind of forgot to catch clips at that point for at least the next couple 3 minutes. Like, I'm recording stuff? That is weird, you know. So here it is for your entertainment.
I can't believe that just fucking happened!
Poor cat. Poor cat. That moment is also pretty titular in the movie.
Yeah, in a way, it reminded me of, and I was probably a little inspired by, the Bonnie incident sequence in Pulp Fiction.
It pulled me right back to that.
Which, when he's like leaning over the back seat and talking to the guy in the back seat and has his gun there, but isn't really thinking about it. They hit a bump, gun goes off, blows the guy's head all over the back window. It's just not quite the same graphic, but it was so similar in context and was so sudden And the cat, it took me a second to figure out what the hell had happened. I had to really
pull it back again to remember.
I went back and watched that scene 5 or 6 times, and finally I put it in as slow a motion as my device was capable of so I could watch it, not quite frame by frame, but, and they did such a fabulous job with it.
And then there's the scene, 10 minutes later where he's having his panic attack and throwing stuff in bags and with the roommates. Wow.
And they had posted a picture of the woman holding her cat over the bullet hole with the smear.
Fantastic.
The blood smear.
Let's see, OBKB?
Put it on! You look fucking scary, man! Now, Rock, are you sure that you're OBKB?
OBKB!
Without the Mush Mouth reference, that doesn't make quite as much sense.
What a crazy pull for 2020, because nobody's thinking, I need another Fat Albert reference in my media right now.
Hey, it was 2000.
How many people would not even get that today?
Most of them.
Well,
almost no one would get it today.
Most of them younger than us anyways. Yeah.
I feel so young. It's great because I didn't get it.
You didn't get it. No, that's fair. We haven't talked about Rocco. We haven't really talked about Rocco at all.
We really haven't talked about Rocco.
He's my wife so good. Loves this movie, but she violently hates that character.
I hate
Why?
Rocco. Rocco's horrible.
Yeah, so good.
I like him because I hate him.
I think he was such a good foil. The whole thing with Smecker being thrown off, because first it was, the two guys, then it was the three guys, there was the one guy that was inept.
And there's the two Irish and then the Italian who might shoot you.
Right. Yeah. When he put everything together. And then, of course, the sequence without Rocco, the sequence in the church with the confessional could not have happened.
Right.
And it was pivotal.
Mm-hmm. It was such
was
a good
pivotal.
Scene.
So it was really, I think it was really important character, but damn, he was annoying.
And that's what he was made definitely him the funny guy. The
show.
He was supposed to be annoying.
But I hate people that are supposed to be annoying.
But he was also the guy who was trying, but not there. And it showed you how the brothers really had a specific set of morals and they were sticking straight to them.
Not only that, they were synced in with each other, and Rocco was kind of an outsider trying so hard to sink in, and it just didn't quite click.
I'm trying to figure out how he got in with that group anyway. He was he was an Italian package boy for the Italian mob, yet he went and hung out with all of the very, very, very Irish people at Docks.
Maybe the Italians didn't like him either.
Probably since they were kids.
It's obvious that the Italians didn't like him, because that's a plot point.
They treated him like crap.
Yeah, good point.
That is a plot point. Funny man.
All right. Ready for this? Il Duce.
Oh.
Whenever we needed one of our own bumped off, we'd call this guy in. He had a thing for clipping wise guys. But only one rule. No woman, no kids. Believe me, kid, you don't want this guy unless you are 100% sure you need him.
I didn't get it then. I really should. That was the first clue, right? No women, no kids. The same thing about
the
innocence.
Same loyalty that the boys have.
Phrased differently.
Yeah, it's phrased enough differently that the comparison isn't immediately apparent.
And it shouldn't be. And it's beautiful.
Yeah,
and based on the scene in the meatpacking plant, they don't necessarily have a problem with violence towards women.
She did swing first.
Yeah. That was actually a talking point.
The big mule kick straight to the groin. But that's aside the point. It's not an honor. It's never a verbalized honor code with them.
The
only thing they say is innocent.
There's also a difference between starting violence with women and being sexist. They were a little sexist.
That's one of the reasons I mentioned that it was phrased differently, because theirs was about innocence, plain and simple.
Yeah, theirs was about innocence, not about sexism.
Yeah. So, make of that what you will, right?
Yeah.
I got the Smucker hoedown here. Smecker hoedown. let's see.
They use ammonia. None of this is any good. Fuck! You know what that means?
Even if we get suspects in the case, we got nothing. Fuck! Who the fuck are they? I've never seen any fucking thing like this in my fucking life! Who the fuck are they?
I love that that was after the scene where it was like six gunmen faced off in the road.
Yeah.
And while he's saying it, they're showing us the sequence of Wilducci showing up with six guns.
But when they were showing him in the scene, it had the six guys lined up behind him.
Yeah, it had the six guys lined up with Smecker, and then Greeley said the right thing. His only time in the entire movie.
The only time in the movie, Greeley goes, what if it's just one guy with six guns?
Yeah.
And he was right.
I also love how Smecker turned into this guy who sat down, who like parodied the people he was explaining what they'd done. So they'd have sequences where he was like, he said, and then the guy knelt, he dropped to his knees, and they show him dropping to his knees and firing his fingers guns, off, yeah. Just like with him right beside him in the frame. It was, that stuff was really clever. You know,
because
you had no question in your head what was going on the way they framed it, the way they narrated it. Mm-hmm. But it was so seamless the way they sequenced it. That was good directing. This guy did a great job with this.
So beautiful.
Which sequence was it in Killing that Smecker did the river dance?
That was in the hotel.
Was
the
Russian okay. hotel. Yeah, the Russian mob bosses.
I cannot remember the quote on that one.
I guess we can talk about this now.
Yeah, good time.
One of my biggest hates of the movie is also one of my biggest loves. All of the Smecker evidence scenes when he's going through the process. Oh my God, such bad forensics. Bad forensics. Horrible forensics. Touching bodies, getting blood everywhere.
He did put on gloves before he did anything, though.
Yeah, he put on gloves and then touched the bodies and then put his hands on his head to the visible disturbance of the people around him. The other cops are like, ew. He just put...
He's a very theatrical character.
Horrible. Yeah. But... anything that he did, even if they hadn't used ammonia, his crime scenes would have been toast.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have been able to use anything, even if the Boondock Saints hadn't used ammonia.
Because of the chain of evidence, yeah.
Yeah, the chain of evidence and the way they do things and the way they handle things and him dancing on the sofa while talking to people. No, that's not how you do it. It was artistic. It was beautiful. It was so much fun. But it was horrible forensics.
But he is that trope of a character who is so great of a detective, he can find the solutions in unorthodox ways and come to the right answer.
Yeah.
That's very trope.
They also did a fantastic job with that because it started out a subtle thing. In the very first forensic scene in the show, he was actually a pretty serious character. He put his earphones in and he's listening to the opera.
Dancing down the alley was great.
Yeah. but he looks like some, you know, just super fucking detective from wherever. And
FBI,
scene by scene, episode by episode, they keep aggravating it and magnifying it and exponentially exaggerating it until.
Right.
You know, you have him, this disheveled mess, screaming and waving his hands.
On the one hand, they're building layers. On the other hand, they're tearing layers away.
There was a firefight!
Uh-huh. Oh, and that was so beautiful. But it was at that point that I realized that this entire movie is evolving that way. It's becoming more exaggerated, but it's also becoming more artistic and more poetic.
Less real.
Less real, exactly.
Yeah. Arc is
scene by scene.
So
it
beautiful.
Starts out gritty and very real. And, you know, the bar scene feels like...
leading all the way up to the courtroom scene at the end.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is almost this epic fantasy of vengeance and justice that just, you know, leaves you quivering.
With an entire team of cops on their side.
Yes! It's so beautifully done. They pace that evolution so perfectly that I don't think I even really became aware of it until the third or fourth time I'm watching the movie. And I was like, holy shit, this is incredible how well they have calculated that departure from reality and descent into madness. It's beautiful.
I have just a couple more clips to knock out here real quick.
Okay. Oh.
Go ahead and get them out here so that we can enjoy it together. Last rites.
Our hand ascended for the light. That our feet may swiftly carry out thy command. We will flow a river forth unto thee, and teeming with souls shall it ever be. In only part we fill your spirit with light.
I honestly thought when I pulled that clip that I was probably pulling my last clip of the movie.
Nope.
That's how wrong I was.
That's how wrong you were.
And to be fair, I could have clipped the next 15 minutes of the movie in its entirety and would have enjoyed the hell out of playing it on this show.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Our listeners probably wouldn't have, but that's
real
okay.
Real quick before we move on.
Yeah.
That might be the one cinematic choice the director made that makes me go, why? They had that super uptight shot of the brothers, and then a super upshot tight of Il Duce, and then a super upshot tight of the hand on the cheek. If they had had a wide lens and had Dad, the two boys on their knees, and the hands on the cheeks, that could have been one of the most beautiful shots in the movie.
I think that was an opportunity missed.
And they didn't take it. I was like, was their wide-angle camera broken that day? Because that would have been such a shot with Dad and the boys.
It's literally the reunion. I wouldn't have even thought of it if you hadn't said it, but that would have been astounding.
And it might be that they were still trying to understate it a tad so in case you miss it. Or it could be simply something more mundane, like they tried a wide-angle shot and it didn't look good, or the lighting was awful.
They left the lens at the office,
They didn't have enough film. Remember, they didn't have a whole lot of digital stuff going on at this point. So, like a river.
Never shall innocent blood be shed, yet the blood of the wicked shall flow like a river. The three shall spread their blackened wings and be the vengeful striking hammer of God.
The whole point, right? You know, and it went on. I like I said, I could have just kept clipping.
Oh yeah,
you just keep going with this bitch. That's pretty much all I got. I guess I had this real short.
Where are we gonna take this?
The question is not how far. The question is, do you possess the constitution, the depth of faith, to go as far as is needed?
Which is the denouement. So, I mean, in toto, I mean, we listened to the show in pieces, and I realized I could have made some different choices in pulling clips, but overall, we have a total story, even in just the little pieces that we got there.
Oh,
that
absolutely.
I felt was expertly told. And I didn't feel like there was any bloat in the film. I mean, I kept waiting to see. There were a couple points I was like, I wonder if this is going to be the last scene. But, you know, I had no sense of pacing when I was doing it, so it was hard to kind of structure it. But that's everything I got. You guys feel pretty good about that? I feel pretty good about it. It was pretty good.
Yeah, good clips.
I think it's time for the fun stuff. What do you guys think?
I do need to get in here real quick because I wanted to take the opportunity to throw up a quick contrast. Back when we did Constantine, and there were a few things I could actually compare between these movies, but this is the one I wanted to hit on. I was very unhappy with Constantine because they strongly included religion as a driving factor in the film, but they did a slipshod job of it. This is how it's supposed to be done.
Yes.
This is how it's supposed to be done. I don't even know. I thought about doing the research, and I just didn't do it. I don't know if there is any sect of Catholicism out there. There's so many that is even remotely in line with where this movie kind of pulls its theme from, but it doesn't matter. They obviously had an expert advising them on how to include the religious elements in this movie that are taken from real life and put them in there correctly, because it's absolutely impeccable. And then the religious theme of, you know, God's executioners is introduced in such a fashion that it feels very much a part of that living, breathing world. This is how it's done.
Yeah.
I was very impressed. And whoever they had doing John Constantine really should have taken notes from this guy, because, wow.
On that note. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Rich?
Well, I'm going to say my thumbs down basically was the cringiness that it was supposed to bring to me. It's anti-PC all over the place. It's the world has a lot going on there. I love the movie, though, and if there's going to be something I dislike, it is going to be the anti-PC, where I'm laughing at things that I'm not even comfortable talking about because of the way the movie's written. As far as my thumbs up goes, I'm zoning in on Willem Dafoe. Because all the characters are great, but his character, the acting brought the most complicated character to full height through the arc of the film. And I'm not even offended with several parts in his character arc that if I saw anybody else doing something similar, I would be totally offended by. I'm going to give this overall 4 stars. If you can deal with the anti-PC, the high gun count, and the mafia setting, you should check it out.
Nice. It's Vanessa.
Say mine, thumbs up, character portrayals. Realistically, the two brothers, I could have pictured them as brothers. They acted like brothers, even to the point of like the little like fake wrestling things that they did at a couple points. I can see brothers doing that. So well cast, so well done. Willem Dafoe, because Willem Dafoe, he's great in everything I've ever seen him in. Thumbs down. So much use of the word fuck. So much. I didn't even remember there being that much. I think my memory like blocked it out before the rewatch.
Oh, we could find movies that do it worse. I mean, we really can.
I get that. I haven't seen a lot of them.
Not a lot, very though, right? Few. Yeah. You had a chart, didn't you?
Yeah. So you found somewhere. This is like 10 or 15 on the list.
Yeah, there were some others. And, I'd seen them. I'd seen several of them.
My other thumbs down was the character believability on the arc, because the brothers went from getting in a fist fight with the Russian mob and for some reason dropping a toilet on their head to being able to shoot 8 shots and hitting a kill shot on every single shot with no transition.
Interesting point. I mean, the assumption being that they were just that good anyway, obviously, but yeah, I think but maybe
no one is that inherently good at shooting.
The bullets were guided by a higher power.
Not only that, they were spinning around suspended by a rope, spinning around in a circle.
Higher power, ye of little faith.
I strongly felt like they made those scenes ridiculous specifically for the purpose of putting in the insinuation that this was divine guidance, divine
protection. It would have to be, because nothing else could guide the bullet. Someone who's never picked up one of these guns before is not going to drop from an air vent suspended by a rope and shoot everyone with a kill shot.
Well, that and it but makes Spectre's follow-up scene
with
that much
their
greater
reaction to it, because they reacted in a
nice.
Exactly. Now, don't get me wrong, I loved that scene. I thought it was well done. It still took away from the character believability.
Mm-hmm. I didn't care at that point. My disbelief was so far in suspension. It was completely emulsified.
My overall rating was 3.5. I couldn't quite get to that 4, but I could not drop to the 3.
That's cool. I like that. That's good. Good explanation.
Yeah.
Jason?
I have to almost completely echo Vanessa. My thumbs up was the acting and the cinematography. It was shot beautifully, with the exception of all the cuts. I really hated the black cuts. They were so jarring and so many of them all the time, especially in the beginning. Like, the first 20 minutes, there was 12 black cuts. It's like, oh! Yeah. Loved the way it was shot and the absurdity of it all, but so perfectly absurd and so much fun to watch. But that ties in directly to my thumbs down. It was so much fun to watch, but it was horrible. None of that could happen ever. Nothing would work the way that it works in this movie. It's just wrong. It's like Jason was talking about the religion being slapshod in Constantine. Physics were slapshod in Boondock Saints. That's not how bullets work. That's not how shooting works. The gun on the table when they exploded the cat, which is one of the most beautiful scenes of the movie. The gun didn't move. It's like it was glued down. Even if you could hit a table and the trigger be so sensitive that the gun fires, the gun would have jumped about 6 inches and flew off the table probably, and then shot again. But no, it just sits there. Cat's gone. Gun's in the exact same spot.
And their only response is, do you think he's dead?
Yeah, the response is, I can't believe that just fucking happened.
Do you think it's dead?
Do you think it's dead? Yeah, probably gone.
It's dead.
So many Wait things for it. Wrong. Wait.
I can't believe that just fucking happened.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so many things wrong. So many things. Go back to the very beginning of the film. The Russians come to get their redemption. They have them chained and bound and at gunpoint. I was going to kill you, but now I'm going to kill your brother. So instead of pulling the trigger on both of them right there with no witnesses in a dirty abandoned building, he takes him to the alley to put
daylight.
Him on his knees in daylight in front of the public, giving the other guy time to... If my brother had just been taken by mobsters and was about to get shot, I think I would have chased after them, not gone upstairs.
Carrying the toilet, yeah.
Carrying the toilet. So many things wrong. But all of those things wrong are what made it so much fun, and I almost hate myself for it. I hate myself for how, kind of like Richard was talking about the non-PC things. Every time one of the non-PC things popped up, I'm like, this shouldn't be funny. I'm not, no.
And yet you're still laughing.
But I'm laughing, and I'm enjoying the nonsense of it because they have set this world up to be so far removed from reality.
Plainly, two wrongs do not make a right, but 37 wrongs do.
Apparently, yeah. Yeah, so many wrong things versus so few right things, but they all work so well. I also give it a 3.5 stars.
Oh, nice. All right. You got your work cut out for you, kid.
Right?
Good luck. All right, what do you got?
Okay.
Ditto. Okay.
Thumbs up. The climax of the movie. The courtroom scene. That was the payoff of an incredible ride. I loved the buildup every step of the way. Evidently, we all did. But when we got to that scene, the first time I watched this movie, I was literally writhing around because I could not contain my enthusiasm and my energy and my laughter and just my glee at this absolutely insane portrayal of a bad guy getting his in the most unrealistic but beautifully public and blatant and fuck you way possible. I fell in love with the movie before I got to that point, but I knew I would stay in love with it at that scene. So out of all the incredible thrill ride that Boondock Saints was, that one scene is my biggest thumbs up. And my biggest thumbs down is also one scene. It's a very small one, a tiny one, but out of all the irreverence, and we've talked about this a lot, all the offensive stuff that they crammed into this movie that you know is wrong and you just can't have your normal reaction to it because it's in this setting and everything's going on. At the Smut Club shooting, when the girl is passed out and they do a close-up of the stripper's breast and Rocco fondling it, that really bugged me. It was gratuitous. It could have been cut from the movie without hurting anything. It did not belong there.
Illustrating him as a further slime ball of his own.
We know he's crud. We didn't need that. And it was literally the only gratuitous boob shot in the entire movie.
Which is saying something. I mean, it's an R-rated movie with a lot of violence, a lot of blood in it. They could have done anything they wanted to and still had the same same reaction.
Once you got an R-rating, you might as well put a boob in.
You might milk it, right? Yeah, but they had a topless dancer there. They could have put her in there in a way that wasn't that blatantly just wrong. I don't know. That scene really bugged me, and it is my singular biggest thumbs down that of the movie.
Definitely is a good one to be a thumbs down.
I pointed out earlier, there are a lot of things wrong with this movie, and Jason's thumbs down, you really kind of explained that for me, so I didn't need to say any more. All those things wrong, I still love this movie like few things else. I give it 4.5 stars.
Nice.
Well,
I might surprise you a little bit. I actually was going to go the 3.5 route, but there's one thing I think is really important kind of to the viewing experience in this movie, and that's that we're watching it in 2020, and it wasn't filmed in 2020.
No, that is true.
And I feel like the filmmaking in this, I would love to be able to go back in time for myself and support more independent artists and independent filmmakers, because I did not do enough of that when I was young. I did not care. And as an artist and as a person who appreciates art and the effort that goes into doing something that you're passionate about, this guy obviously was. Like I said, only thing he did. I'm going to go ahead and give it 4 stars. I think that it was, if it wasn't meaningful at the time, it was trying to be and was doing it in the right way. And I think that that is just a sign of good filmmaking, trying to be relevant, trying to be appropriate and sensitive to the time you're in and still pushing boundaries. And I think great art has to push boundaries. And that's what's important about it. I'm not saying I wouldn't call it a perfect movie in my retrospect. I did feel like, to me, even trying to look past the issue I had with the way I watched it, I feel like the pacing wasn't quite what I wanted. The cuts bugged me. There were things that bothered me about the choices that were made in the filmmaking and the narrative and the storytelling. And it was not enough to detract from what was great about the movie. Overall, 4 stars. So I don't know what does that give us.
Runs up to a 3.9, so it's going to be a solid 4 star at the end.
Awesome, awesome, awesome.
Ooh, one scene we never talked about: Paul Smecker in a dress.
Oh, yeah, amazing!
What the hell?
And that kiss.
Oh, the kiss.
Oh yeah. I don't know how we missed this, but I just thought about
that kiss so much.
Oh my god, that was so good.
Acting during the kiss, he put the perfect amount of everything in that kiss, where his own disgust at himself, but his enjoyment of the physical act of doing it. All in him. Oh, Willem Dafoe, I love you.
It's the only reason he's still alive.
Yep.
Straight up.
Because Ilduce doesn't kill women. He would have got a bullet to the back of the head. Instead, he got pistol whipped.
Yeah.
Next week, we're going to do Knight's Tale.
Yes.
I think.
Oh.
Our schedule.
Oh, good lord.
And then we got so watch that if you can join us next. We've got Alice in Wonderland coming up, the Tim Burton one. And of course, some Starship Troopers on the horizon, too. I think that's good movies on the docket. So
it's
a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed episode number 5 of Exposition Street. For Rich, for Vanessa, for Jason, and the kid, I'm Eric. Get on out of here for today. Everybody have a fantastic week. Drop by and leave us some love on our Discord channel, or drop us a line of feedback at prismaticsonami.com.
Thanks for watching.
Was that for those of you watching at home? Because, you know, we're not actually a watch podcast. It's right. Over. If they didn't watch by now, it's done.
Right.
They're done. They're gone.
Right.
It's all good.
Right.
Yeah, thanks.
Right. Right.